Hello everyone and welcome back to Footprints. Spring is really beginning to get going now. The trees are budding, blossom is falling, and our gardens are starting to come back to life after their long winter rest. And so we thought, well, it's time to explore all things gardens and gardening. We're going to take you back to the 18th century and show you the only Georgian pleasure gardens left in the UK. Yes, they're right here in Bath. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of composting and lawns with Wild About Bath, and Avon Wildlife Trust will give advice on the best ways to encourage wildlife into our gardens. But first, let's start with a community garden that specialises in growing veg. I met up with Carol Stone, one of the volunteers from Alice Park Gardens, just down below Lark Hall on the London Road. If you have always wanted to know how to stop slugs and aphids munching your beans, well, listen in. I've never been here before. It's a huge park with this beautiful garden around the back. Tell me about how it all started.
It was found by Cathy Cook in the dim mists of time. It was an abandoned back garden for the nursery building, which is in front of us here. And she was part of Transition Lark Hall and immediately seized on the idea that it could be a community garden. It's gone through various iterations of being really busy and doing lots of different things and then having quieter moments. In its current state, it's actually a food growing site. I call it a demonstration garden because there's lots of climate friendly practicalities about how you might grow food in your own space, but also how you might also live your life to reduce your carbon footprint. And as well as that, it's also a space for people to come for their well-being. You know, a lot of people just come and sit, and that's perfectly fine. You don't have to be a volunteer, but it helps. We run a Sunday volunteer session every week. And those are the people who actually hold the garden together and do the regular growing, seed sowing, maintaining all the open spaces, maintaining our little forest garden.
And you're tucked in behind a big hedge in the middle of the park, but there's also other things in the park. Just describe the area for me.
So it's a relatively large park, I think, in Bath terms. There's lots of mature, interesting trees. We had the urban tree trail folk come and point out some of the really unusual specimens you wouldn't normally expect in just an open space. The yew hedge is an original feature from the 1930s, and it's immaculate. It's cared for by the Parks Department, but it also provides us with a lovely sense of sanctuary here. We're sheltered from the wind, whereas the rest of the park is much more open. It's got lots of facilities. There's a lovely cafe. Obviously, public toilets are a real benefit here. Little sheltered places to sit. There's a play area. There's a skate park. There's tennis courts. And it's very child-friendly in that there's a path all the way around. And it's at its best at the moment. The cherry blossom's about to burst.
It's all beginning to take off, isn't it? So I think we should go and have a look. Yeah. Show me round.
In this area of the garden, we've got some overwintering vegetables, basically. Spinach is indestructible, lovely fleshy green leaves at the moment that can be picked and put into salads, which is delicious. We've also planted a green manure or living mulch. And the idea is over winter, the plants grow and hold on to all the nutrients in the soil rather than if it was bare soil, the rain might well wash nutrients out so they're not available for future crops. So part of the work we do is to run workshops like on fermentation and seed saving. And we've done natural plant dyeing. We've done how to make natural cordage in the last year.
Natural cordage? Do you mean like string?
Like string. Oh. Some people will have heard about this film called The Nettle Dress, where this chap makes a dress out of nettles. And he weaves the fibre and then he makes the dress as a memorial to his wife, who sadly died during his 7-year collection of nettles. But the idea is that as well as the basic food crops, there are other crops that you can gather from an area. It might be your garden, it might be an allotment, it might be a public open space like this one. So some of it's about foraging, some of it's looking at plants you know, but look at them in a different light, basically. Lovely nettles. People eat them for soup and make pesto and put them in nettle and potato cakes and things like that. We're looking at the coal frame, which was built by one of our volunteers, and it's being used at the moment to house some sweet peas. They're ready to go in the ground, and I think we're just making a decision about where they should go. Normally it's something we have in the garden because people so enjoy it. It's very nostalgic, those scents of spring and summer. It's just delicious, and they're really good for pollinators. Over here, you can just see beneath our raspberry canes, we've got seedling marigolds coming up in their thousands. If we can't this way, if we walk a bit further, the nets you mentioned earlier are very much, we have a very big pigeon population, so we do have to net.
Okay, so we're thinking about creatures that feed off what we're trying to grow. What do you do about slugs?
I love slugs. Yeah, so not all slugs are bad is the real message. Obviously, it is disappointing when you put in your precious, prized seedlings straight out into the ground that overnight they've all disappeared. But there are quite a few different methods you can use to reduce slug problems. Good garden hygiene is one of them. Most slugs like to live on the dead material that drops when your crops are just going over, like the leaves at the base of cabbages or your spinach leaves, and they go all soggy. Most slugs are just eating dead material that's fallen by the wayside, and they're actually doing a really important job of recycling nutrients into the soil and keeping it healthy. It's completely organic, this garden. We don't use any pesticides, we don't use any chemicals. We just try and work with nature as much as we can. And one of the methods of doing that is to use modular planting. So instead of planting direct into the soil, you'd sow seeds in little trays in the greenhouse so that they're protected at that very fragile and vulnerable stage. And then later on, once they're a little bit bigger and tougher, the slugs tend to not like tough vegetation. So you've kind of put them out of their comfort zone and the plants can go in and they're more likely to survive. And also, obviously, you can encourage other forms of wildlife. That's a robin screaming away up there, I think. And obviously, birds are really important in this garden to keep on top of any of the friendly mollusks that we tend to have everywhere in the garden.
Yeah, so slugs, snails. I mean, I'm looking at broad beans. Whenever I've grown broad beans, they've just been completely demolished by blackfly. How do you manage blackfly, greenfly? The little tiny winged insects.
All those aphids. Greenfly and blackfly are a persistent problem. Mainly, you know, from about April onwards, they start breeding in vast numbers. By planting your broad beans in the autumn, the theory is that they grow and these are already in flower, and so that you'll get an early crop of beans. You can probably sidestep that April, May, when all the aphids start breeding, because you've already got most of your crop in place. The other thing that most people do is pinch the tops out. That's a sort of standard practice that my father taught me about when I started to learn to grow an awful long time ago. Pinch the tops out. Some people use broad bean tops to make a pesto, so it's not wasted. It's very much about thinking about getting more than one crop out of one plant, really. We've got some leaf mould here. Leaf mould is a really cheap and cheerful way of increasing organic matter in your soil. Because it breaks down using fungi rather than bacteria, it switches your soil to be more healthy. It's got more microbes active in it. The fungal hyphae, these networks of tubes that go through the soil, help to transport nutrients around and benefit the plants you've got growing. So if you can add leaf mould in preference to something like animal manure, which is much more nutrient rich, but gives a boost, a really quick boost, and encourages plants to grow really quickly and sappy and not very healthily. Whereas if you try and move towards slower growth, plants generally grow more slowly, build up more nutrients because they're doing all the things that a chemical factory in the plant should be doing. And gradually, with leaf mould, you can get a much more nutritious plant at the end of the day. It will fend off pests and diseases much better because it's got the whole complement of friendly bacteria, friendly microbes, and friendly fungal partners.
It is very tranquil here, isn't it? You can just hear the birds. I mean, there's a bit of traffic, but
there's a brimstone butterfly just flying past there.
Yes.
Oh, how lovely. And we've got a pond in the garden. We could go up and have a look at that.
Let's get to the pond.
A lot of creatures, having a source of water in the garden is really important. You'll see bees and wasps coming down to have a drink, believe it or not. Obviously, it's really good for amphibians. We get dragonflies and damselflies, whirligig beetles, all sorts of really interesting creatures. And the pond does have frogs in it and some toads occasionally.
And it's a very beautiful part of the world, isn't it? really lovely here. I could hear a wren just now. So many birds. I can't see any of them, but I can hear them. Huge rosemary bush that's in flower.
We do have a local chef who comes here to make sure he's got his organic rosemary for his Sunday roast.
Well, thank you, Carol, so much for showing me around.
I've really enjoyed it, sharing it with you. Thank you.
That's the robin. Oh, thanks there to Carol. And if you'd like to get involved, they run volunteer sessions between 11 and 1 every Sunday. You just turn up. Next up, let's turn the clock back more than two centuries and find out about the design of Bath's pleasure gardens with Marion Harney. She is Professor of Buildings and Landscape Conservation at the University of Bath, and here she is to show us around Sydney Gardens and tell us what the Georgians did for fun.
So we're standing here in Sydney Gardens outside of what is now the Holborn Museum, but was originally the Sydney Tap, which was a kind of bar and entertainment place, which was the centrepiece for entering the gardens. That's the way everyone came in. And at the back of the building here now, there's this Eric Parry extension, but in the late 18th century, in the 1790s when the building was built, outside the back of here there was galleries and supper boxes so that you could come here for the entertainment for the evening, and the pleasure gardens were all laid out for you to walk around, and they were illuminated, and as I say, you could come in here, you could eat and drink. There was places if you wanted to come for a coffee or a tea, and you could sit and read the London papers while you were here and just meet with friends and generally have entertainment both during the day and in the evenings. The gardens were developed in 1794, and Jane Austen lived across the road from Sydney Gardens in about 1804, so they'd been open for about 10 years when she was living in Sydney Place before they found a house in the centre of town. They stayed there, and she writes often, both in her novels, Persuasion and Northanger Abbey, about visiting the pleasure gardens and the entertainment. As I say, she talks about it in letters to her sister as well, about how much she enjoyed coming to the gardens, particularly to the labyrinth, which was a kind of maze with walks through it and little rustic huts and that kind of thing. And at the centre of that maze, there was what was known as a Merlin swing, which various people have tried to describe what it's like. Apparently, it's like a big swing boat thing where you could get at least four people in. So I think she probably enjoyed that. The hotel and the gardens were designed by Charles Harcourt Masters in 1794. Pleasure Gardens started in London with Vauxhall Gardens, but they've all gone now. They've all been completely built over. So this is listed Grade 2, and it's the only remaining pleasure garden in the UK that is largely intact. It lost some of its design features when the canal and the railway came through, but one of the most significant intrusions really was part of the gardens were sold off for housing on the west side, so you couldn't get all of the way around the garden in the way that you could in the late 18th and early 19th century. The only real feature it's lost is that ride that went right around the perimeter. Everything else, the kind of layout of the paths and the main axis, remain as they were in the 18th century. So it's a very important garden. So now we're standing at the back of what is now the Holborn Museum, what was the Sydney Tap. So you would come through the building and you would come out into the garden, and this still remains the main axis that was there, with the loggia at the top of the garden, which was always lit with candles and chandeliers and things. So that was the main axis, that was the main walking route, and most of the illustrations of the gardens are of that route and people walking up and down there. You came here to see and be seen. People watching is not a new thing. Mm-hmm. The gardens remained a visitor attraction for quite a long time, right up until the kind of early 19th century. And then seaside destinations became more popular than coming to visit places like Bath for the spa and the entertainment. And people started going to the seaside. So the beginning of the gardens losing some of their original design was in the 19th century. First in 1810, when the Kennetonavon Canal was cut through, and then in 1840, the railway came through. It completely dissected the garden, cut it in half, and they did put bridges through. So while it impacted on the original design, it is a design feature in itself now, in a place, you know, that people come to watch. So it's still largely intact, but not quite complete. The renaissance of the garden started in about 2011 when the Eric Parry extension, which is a gallery extension on the back of the Holborn Museum, because it changed from being a pub and had various different uses. You know, it was a school, it was a hydropathic establishment, and then in 1916 the Holborn Museum bought it to display William Holborn's collection. So they've been there for over 100 years now. So then in 2015, we got a feasibility study about restoring the gardens with the Heritage Lottery Fund and the Big Lottery Fund. Normally, restoration projects are trying to restore it back to its original concept or original design. But this very deliberately was not trying to do that. What it was doing was making a pleasure garden for the 21st century for future generations of children and people to come and play. So now what you see now is this magnificent new play area, which is suitable for all ages, from toddlers to, you know, you get teenagers coming and playing football and basketball in it. There's the slides, the swings, the climbing frames. So it's been a hugely successful revitalisation of the gardens, bringing back life into the gardens, really. Yeah. Okay, now we can walk up to the top of what was, as I mentioned earlier, the original main axis of the gardens to the loggia at the top of the gardens. As we're walking up here, on the right, there's a small iron gate, which is the gate through to the Kennetonavon Canal, which John Rennie constructed in 1810. So it's become part of the reason to come to the gardens, because you can get access straight to the canal there. So you can walk through the pleasure gardens, have a walk up and down the Kennetonavon Canal, which was restored in the 1990s, and then come back here for your coffee or a glass of wine or lunch. This is the Kennetonavon Canal. And the building you can see in front of you, Cleveland House there, was the Kennetonavon Canal headquarters. And if you walk along the towpath and under the bridge, there's actually a cut, like a loft access in the ceiling. And that's where they used to drop through the mail as the canal boats went through to take the mail on. The bridges that they put through are very architectural as well. They're nice architectural pieces in their own right, so they didn't just cut through and leave nothing. They did make it a feature as part of the gardens. So this building is known as the loggia or exedra. This was one of the main features of the walk in the 1790s, and it used to have wings either side, but they have now gone. If it was raining, you would walk up here and sit in the loggia. So it's basically an outdoor space. This little Georgian garden's been restored at the back of it to get some of the 18th century flavour back into it. So So now there's a group called the Friends of Sydney Gardens, and they're a very active group that put on lectures and walks and various other entertainments. The Friends of Sydney Gardens raise money through, like, I came and gave a lecture on pleasure gardens for them, and there was about 40 people came, and all of the money for that goes towards the upkeep and restoration of the gardens. And they come here out every day, every weekend, they pick litter. They help with the groundsmen, the local authority groundsmen, who have the main remit for looking after the park. But the Friends do a lot of work. There's a lot of volunteers go on pruning, planting bulbs. And this little Georgian garden that we're looking at just outside the loggia was commissioned by the Friends of Sydney Gardens and designed by one of my former students when I ran an MSc in the conservation of historic gardens and landscapes. So we've got a very nice little garden that's been recreated as a little gem of Georgian recreation.
Oh, thanks so much to Professor Marion Harney for showing us around Sydney Gardens. Now, Amy Cook is a community ecologist from the Avon Wildlife Trust, and it's her job to give advice on how to improve our back gardens and green spaces in terms of wildlife and biodiversity. So, it seemed the only thing to do was to invite her into my own back garden to see what she could advise. Yeah, so this is the first time you've seen this garden, Amy.
Yeah.
What's your initial response?
Well, it's very loved and cared for. I am seeing quite a lot of bamboo there, which
has spread.
Spread, yeah, bamboo does tend to do that. So you've got some really lovely spring flowers coming through here. Firstly, when we're looking at green spaces, how people want to improve them for wildlife, we try to get an idea of what the capacity is, what people's time they can spend in the garden, whether there's certain times of year they use it more than others. And the main sort of features that we're trying to provide in a green space is pollinator opportunities, habitat opportunities, and hibernation options. So right here, we've got lots of spring tulips, daffodils, all fantastic sources of pollen for early pollinators. So the model that we're often trying to promote at the Wildlife Trust is a build it and they will come style green space. If you're able to provide water sources and pollination sources and some areas where animals can take cover, whether that's in trees, shrubs, bushes, or hedgehog hides, bird and bat boxes, bug hotels, you're providing lots of options for animals to feel at home and have everything that they need in your green space. When planting, you really want to go with creating the effect of the garden that suits you best, whether that's going to be ornamentals or sort of a wilder style with more native wildflowers. As a Wildlife Trust, we do promote people to avoid sort of invasive non-natives. Typically, we want to encourage people to be planting berry-producing shrubs, small trees, native larger trees if they have the ability. Because, again, you're providing those year-round sources of food.
Yes, now this is one of the things that always gets me with gardening. You've got to think in so many different dimensions, haven't you? You've got to think of what you're going to be able to see throughout the year. Then you've got to be able to think what's low, medium, high, so it's some kind of structure. Well, and then you've got to think about, should I be planting for drought or should I be planting for flood? So where do you think it's best to start?
I think identifying the sort of main features that you want to add to your garden is the best place to start, and then building around that. So if you want to have, you know, a really, for example, in this garden, it's sort of a classic terrace garden. It's longer than it is wide, and you've got shared fences, and you've got some climbers on those fences. So, you know, if you're wanting to have taller trees for privacy, or maybe some screening shrubs, or even just the climbers you've got here, then inside the garden, you're going to want to think, okay, so I'm reducing the amount of light that's there. So you would lean more towards shade tolerant varieties, and you might decide you want evergreens. So that's going to mean that you really do have year-round shade as opposed to something that's more deciduous. Spring bulbs are a fantastic addition to almost any space because they give a real beautiful burst of early pollination opportunities, but they do die back pretty quickly. So they're not reliant on sun in the summer. And in the winter, when all the leaves have gone from the trees, they really make the most of those low light conditions. A lot of our wildflowers are quite hardy, especially the ones that you might pick up in wildflower nurseries or even garden centres. There are going to be certain varieties that do much better in acid soils or much better in alkaline soils. And knowing what you're dealing with before you start planting is a great place to be. Taking inspiration from what's around you, I would look at planting areas of ground cover and then possibly having some later annuals coming through. I love foxgloves, so I'd like to look at planting quite a few foxgloves in my space. Whereas here...
Well, so here at the back here, so what we've got is a huge sort of fig, Fatsia.
Yeah.
And then we've got a large flax. And then an area at the back which hasn't really got very much with a bench at the back of it.
Yeah.
You could put foxgloves there, I guess, couldn't
Absolutely.
You? And then wildflowers.
Foxgloves are great because they really like shaded areas. And, you know, they're a really stunning showstopper of a plant. And they actually flower every other year. So you can plant them quite densely and have them popping up in different locations, depending on what year they're flowering. If we just take a look at the soil that you've got here, I don't have my pH tester on me right now, but it's very dark. So it's going to have quite a high humus content. It's going to have quite an organic matter content.
That's because I've added it.
There we go. Yeah. And next to the areas that are quite dark, it looks actually like it might be quite silty or quite clayey. So looking at how well your soil retains moisture throughout the year is also going to give you a good indication. If you've got a really boggy part of your garden, you're going to want to look for sort of almost wetland varieties, wet meadow species, things like betony, yellow flag iris, snake's head fritillary. There's all sorts of varieties of really beautiful native wildflowers that are going to absolutely love the soggy parts of your garden. Let the grass fail. Don't try keeping to reseed the grass. Let the grasses die off if it's too wet and plant something prettier and something more valuable for wildlife.
And so you've talked about what might work well in wet patches, but we've probably all got very dry patches that get even drier in the hot sun. What would work well there? What might we want to plant?
If the ground's going to dry out, the ground's going to dry out, and that's going to cause difficulty for any variety of flowering plant you're going to introduce to the garden. So looking at hardier varieties and looking at varieties that are going to be a bit more drought resistant, so your woody herbs, things like lavender bushes, sage, rosemary, thyme bushes, all of these are going to add like a sensory element. They're all edible, but they're also from areas that are quite drought resistant anyway. You know, they're quite shade tolerant. They're very hardy, rosemary and thyme and lavender.
That'd be lovely to have some of that in the garden, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and rosemary at the moment's flowering. You're going to have a staggered flowering season, so your lavender's going to come through a lot later in the summer, whereas right now rosemary's, you know, in full bloom almost. So yeah, it's definitely tricky to balance when you're getting colour throughout the year. But making sure that if you're going to plant spring flowering varieties, plant them all over the place. You know, if you're going to plant something that flowers later in the year, or something like a hawthorn or a rowan that's going to have red berries, that's going to actually hold onto them throughout the winter.
That's a good idea. Let's just go and have a look at this little tiny container pond, which is what, a metre across, I suppose?
Yeah.
Because I don't think I see many creatures living in here. What do you think about it?
I think that might be because they can't get into it. So the container is raised about a foot off of the ground. So it's going to be a great option for birds, although it might be a little close to the house for birds because you've got the window here and they might get a bit scared by the movement. But yeah, if you want to be seeing newts, toads, frogs using a water body in the garden, even if it's raised, just having part of it that's got a sloping access point will allow them to get in and out of it, of the water body, use it for their spawning, where there's water, frogs will find. They're very indifferent. And it looks quite fresh. I mean, you've got a really nice selection of aquatic plants in there. You've got your yellow flag iris. You've got some mare's tail. So I'm wondering if maybe it's just quite new, and adding that access point for amphibians might sort of help develop the diversity in there. But you should be getting aquatic invertebrates colonising, especially with the plants. With the bamboo down here, it's so dense that I reckon you could probably get a decent number of bird boxes, sort of, not obviously attached to the bamboo, but maybe disguised against the brick walls on each side. Okay. You've got this sort of wooden trellising. I'm wondering if actually maybe popping some bird boxes in there might entice more birds into the space, or popping a standing bird feeder. At this time of year and over the winter, our overwintering birds are really struggling with finding food sources. And so a great way to entice them is by offering them a buffet. And if you don't have trees to hang bird feeders off, putting a standing bird feeder is as good an option. But yeah, that could also be a good way of, you know, enticing the bird life that's in the local area into your green space. And then they'll notice the lovely pond and hopefully use it as a bird bath as well.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks so much, Amy. You just heard Amy Cook advising me on my back garden. She can be contacted through Wave and Wildlife Trust website to give advice or answer queries on your back garden. And you can find details in the programme notes. Now let's finish off with a wild garden above Horsecombe Vale, where I met Kat Baker, who's the manager of Wild About Bath. The garden she chose to show me belongs to her partner's grandmother. We'll hear great tips on composting.
What I love most about this garden is that there's so many different elements to it that's achievable in any garden. It doesn't matter whether you've just got a balcony with a sort of a planter on it, or you live in a terrace and you have a small garden, and nobody would believe it when looking, but everyone can achieve what's in this garden.
I'm intrigued because this garden is pretty big, and from where I'm standing now, it's got a lot going on in it.
One thing I do like about it is that Celia tries to plant native plants in here, and she leaves a lot of what people would normally call weeds, things like the alkanet down there. So she leaves a lot of that, and it's really good for the bees and the early insects as well. I love the lawn. I love that it's not just grass, it's got daisies and dandelions and all sorts of other plants, but it provides, you can see all the daisies out, it provides so much pollen and nectar for the early species of bees and things like that.
It's got lots of moss in it, and lots of people try very hard a lot of the time to get rid of the moss. Do you think that's worth it?
Not really, no. It's a whole nother habitat for other animals, things like woodlice. It means you haven't got to mow the lawn so much, so I can understand why people would like a nice manicured lawn, but I think it's a lot more effort than it's worth.
We're going round the back of the hawthorn hedge.
It's not the prettiest part of the garden, obviously, but it's a fantastic habitat. We get grass snakes in here. This is the part where the magic happens, or the composting happens, and then that compost is later used on the rest of the garden, so it's all going back into the garden.
There are 6 compost bins to my left and a whole pile of prunings to the right.
A lot of people will clean all of this away in their gardens, and even though it's been moved, it's still in the garden. It hasn't been burnt, it hasn't been taken to the tip, it's still here. So all of the insects that will be using these stems to overwinter in, they're still here, they're fine. They'll come out in the summer and lay more eggs, and they haven't been removed.
So there's a lot of woody stems in that huge pile. Mm. Has that all come from last year?
Yeah, some of that has come from this year, because during the winter months, that's when they really start to cut things back and tidy up a little bit in preparation for spring, which is something I think everyone likes to do.
But instead of putting it in the green bin, we're just leaving it in a big pile, mm-hmm. and not doing anything with it until summer.
Until late summer, yeah.
Tell me the tips of making a compost heap.
You can start off quite easily with one of those plastic Daleks. I've got one, and you just pop all your grass cuttings in, or your veg peelings in, and you can leave it. If you just leave it alone and don't touch it, it'll rot down in about a year, maybe 2 years. You can turn it and that will make it rot down quicker. This is, I mean, it's just made out of pallets. It's nice, simple. And again, that will rot down quickly, especially if you turn it. We tend not to turn them because we do get grass snakes laying eggs inside them and things like slow worms and stuff. So we don't turn them.
I noticed that they're lined with plastic.
And that keeps the temperature up and holds all the... I mean, it doesn't hold all of the liquid in because there's holes in the bottom. You can drain the liquid off and use it as a liquid fertiliser.
So when you're making a compost heap, should you fill the whole thing up quite quickly?
No, you don't have to. No, you fill it up as you need to. We're really lucky here because there are so many and they do fill up quickly from all the garden waste. But no, you can add to it as and when. It doesn't have to be filled up straight away. You do have to be careful sometimes of what you add to compost. There are some plants that if you add to your compost heap and then use it in your garden, you could be spreading disease or what some people call weeds around their gardens. So some things you shouldn't add to the compost heap.
So tell me about Wild About Bath.
Wild About Bath was set up originally just by, well, it was during lockdown, just by a few neighbours who wanted to do something during lockdown, I think, and really appreciate the nature, which a lot of people did during lockdown. They got out for walks and really started to see things. And it's blossomed from there, really, with not just the local streets, but Bath as a whole have really come together, and we have some amazing events where we learn about all sorts of different things. The people involved with Wild About Bath, we all have different interests, different things that we know about, and it's been really nice to share that with each other and learn as we go. We've got the seed and plant swap next month, I think that is. We've got a few workshops as well. We've got a gardening workshop later in the year and making some hedgehog tunnels so we can get the footprints of hedgehogs and see where they're going. And we've got an owl pellet dissecting event as well as the walks. And it just looks
an
really
owl pellet dissecting event. You're going to have to tell me more about that.
So owls, when they eat... they eat the whole thing, really, don't they? And they can't digest things like the bones and the feathers and the fur. So they bring it back up again through their mouths. And they quite often leave them lying around and people find them. And you can pick them apart with tweezers and then you can see what they've been eating. Now, it's really interesting from the perspective of seeing what the owl has caught and eaten. But it's also a really good way of seeing what small mammals are in the area. There's a small shrew in the UK that's quite endangered at the moment. So they're using owl pellet dissect. This is the Mammal Society, are using owl pellet dissection to see if they can find any of the skeletons of the shrew and to work out where they are and how many they are there are.
So we've just turned the corner from the second path and we're coming back along the front of the house on a third tier down now, past what looks like A yucca, yeah. It's huge, isn't it?
When the flowers die off, they look like Christmas trees. So sometimes Celia saves them and sprays some silver or gold and uses them as Christmas decorations.
That's brilliant. I love that. Oh, look up there. There's a seagull trying to mob some kind of...
It's a buzzard.
So are they put here specially?
I have no idea why they're put here, but I love them because there's normally always something under them.
So you've just turned up a piece of black guttering to see what's underneath.
Again, it's the sort of thing that people would normally just think, oh, well, it's rubbish, just throw it away. But it's made a nice border and it's, you know, a nice little place to just monitor what's around. Like I said, I always flip it over and there's normally slow worms or grass snakes or lizards underneath it. And if these weren't here, I wouldn't know that because I wouldn't be checking.
And you're right. Originally you said everything in this garden is we can all do it in our own garden, no matter how small.
Yeah.
I suppose we can be a little less tidy.
I'll definitely be a little less tidy. That's probably the biggest thing you can do in a garden. This to just be a little... Or even if you do like a nice manicure garden, just sort of have a little corner. You can hide it with hedges and things so that it's not so obvious, but just have a little corner where you just let it go a bit mad. It can get taken over by brambles or nettles, but just cut them back a little bit. You can manage it.
Okay, we're now off the mown path, down into a...
That's a deer print, that's a muntjac print.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, look at that. It's a tiny little dainty hoof, isn't it?
And there's some fox or badger scat there, so... Oh, that's a roe deer print.
So roe and muntjac?
Roe and muntjac, yeah.
Now, I see a lot of nettles. Tell me about the importance of nettles.
They're really good for conditioning the soil, but they do crowd out other plants as well. They make fantastic food plants for so many insects. It's unreal. Things like the butterflies, peacock butterflies, their caterpillars will live on nettles. You quite often see them later in the year. They'll be covered in black caterpillars that look like they've got stars all over them. And that's a peacock butterfly. In fact, I think... There's one over there flying around. Well, it's just settled down. And when the nettles flower as well, it's a fantastic source of nectar and pollen. And we can use them for many things, which a lot of people don't realise we can. We can eat them. We can use them to make cordage with. And we can use them to make natural fertilisers with as well.
What do you love about gardening?
I love the sense of satisfaction you get from it. If you've grown something that you can eat, or that you can smell, or that you can see, or if you let your garden just go a bit wilder and you grew, teasels, that's one. If you grew teasels, and then in the autumn you get goldfinch coming in your garden, you might never have seen goldfinch before, I didn't. And it's just really exciting to see that either by doing something or not doing something, you've benefited something else. I think that's amazing to just look out your window and just see something that you'd not seen before. That's why I enjoy it.
That's really magical, isn't it? Thank you, Kat.
Thanks so much to Kat Baker from Wild About Bath. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you so much for joining me, and don't forget you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. Please share as widely as you can with your friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and Players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.